Welcome to Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here is the podcast host, James Dellingpole.
Welcome to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole. And I think I can call him my guest. He's my guest, Malcolm Dellingpole, a.k.a. my father, Pa. Welcome to the show, Pa.
Why am I not a special guest?
Because
I don't see you that often.
No, because don't you understand? Dick is my guest, not my special guest. Every non-family member is a special guest.
I do understand. I listen to all your podcasts.
Okay, right. Would you rather be a special guest or a very special guest?
All right. I'll just be an ordinary guest then. Okay.
So I was really excited, I don't know whether you were, at the volume of requests to have you on the show. Maybe they were inspired by Dog Poo Gate, the dog poo incident described in the last podcast with Dick. And various people have submitted questions about all sorts of things. One of them is about the dog poo incident. And of course, this will be the perfect opportunity for you to stir things with one of my brothers. And there are also further questions about sibling rivalry, about your past, about your time in the RAF, and the time you had an E-type Jaguar. So it's going to be an autobiography packed show. Tell me about your E-type first of all, because one of the things when I was growing up, you know how you collect things about your dad that you boast to your mates about, and one of the things I always used to boast to my mates about is that you had one of the first E-type Jaguars in the country, which is pretty impressive.
It was actually, I think, the first in private hands, probably the most famous of all the E-types, because it was Graham Hill's ECD 400. It was the first E-type ever to win a race.
Well, you weren't a billionaire. How did my dad get hold of the first E-type private E-type Jag?
That is a fascinating story. I had the most beautiful car ever built, an AC Bristol, which I had serviced by a chap in London called Bob Gibbons, who had a little garage in an alleyway in central London. One day he said to me, look, Equipe Endeavour, who have this E-type which Graham Hill races, they don't want to advertise it. They want it to be slipped out to a private owner with no fuss. Would you be interested? Huh? Would I be interested? Yes.
Oh, my God. Well, that's amazing. Do you have any idea what it'd be worth if you still had it?
Don't. It yeah. upsets me too much.
I bet it. I mean, we're talking millions, you think?
A lot more than I sold it for.
Yeah, well, can you remember what you paid for it?
About 7,000 or something like that.
Right.
Something ridiculous.
So this was when you were a company director?
At the company director.
So you had a bit of money.
Well, I think actually the company paid for it. I think it was a company car, so it probably never appeared in my name.
Right. And were you married at this stage?
No, I don't think so.
Because obviously the next question is, I mean, what an incredible bird puller.
Oh, it was, yeah. So I can't have been married. No, I was pulling birds and that was an extra special bird puller.
What colour was it?
Blue, dark blue with vivid white lips on the front. It looked, well, it was a very fast phallic symbol.
Right. And did you take it up to its full speed and stuff?
I remember driving from London back to Birmingham along the M1, never dropping below 120 mile an hour.
There were no speed traps in those days, I imagine.
There was no legal limit in those days.
God, those must have been wonderful times to have a sports car.
Yeah.
I mean, don't you look at the world now and think it's really gone to pot?
In those terms, yes. I wouldn't want to own a sports car today, no.
Because you'd lose your licence as soon as you floored the accelerator. And yeah. We live in a sort of anti-car culture, don't we? Your generation was probably the last to really really be able to enjoy their cars?
Now, I enjoy driving. I enjoy cars, but not in the same way as I did when I had the E-Type or the AC Bristol.
Why is the AC Bristol the most beautiful car ever, do you think?
Difficult question. If you remember, the far more famous AC Cobra...
Yeah, which was, is a handsome beast.
...was brutal.
Yeah.
Whereas the Bristol, without the sticky-out wheel arches, was perfection. It was a beautiful design.
Was its performance as good as the AC Cobra?
Oh, no. The Cobra was a great big... powerful engine put inside a delicate little sports car.
Not very good at cornering, I seem to remember you saying.
What, the Cobra?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably better in a straight line, yes.
Yeah. And didn't you lose quite a few mates in AC Cobras?
I lost a lot of friends driving racing cars, yes. It was expected in those days that if you went motor racing, there was a good chance of being killed, yes.
And what was normally the killer? Was it sort of the steering column going through them? Yes.
It was. We didn't have seat belts.
You didn't have seat belts in racing cars? You must have had those straps, surely.
We had nothing. We didn't.
Are you talking about just driving on motorways? Because I mean, surely when you were racing, you strapped in with those. You must have had
seat belts. I remember them coming in later. There was no thought for driver safety in those days.
And I suppose you only know what you know, don't you, in any given time. So did it never strike you, this is a bit dangerous, this is a bit...
No. I when I drove the Dello in the Macau Grand Prix, it was fun. I wanted to drive a sports car in a major race, and the danger never even occurred to me.
Right. Well, you were young then, I suppose, and we don't have any really concept of our mortality when we're younger.
You and your brothers,
yeah,
all had serious car accidents in the box section Ford Escort.
Yeah.
Had you been just a few years earlier,
yeah,
and had been driving Triumph Heralds, you'd all three be dead.
That's quite a sobering thought, actually. Do you think your generation? You just missed out on World War II, and you did your national service
and a bit more.
Do you think you were made of different stuff to my generation or Generation Snowflake?
Probably, yes.
In what sense?
More carefree, debonair.
better looking. Bigger with his.
Yeah, Biggles, yeah.
I didn't say that, but yeah. But yeah, so what, do you think it's because you'd had less pampered upbringings, maybe, or?
No, we just never thought about it.
Right.
If we're going to be killed in a racing car, that was our turn to go.
Right. I think I would have thought like that. Well, I mean, certainly my brief fox hunting career, I never really cared much for the danger. I wonder actually whether one of the things I've inherited from you is a kind of love of a need for speed and stuff.
Yeah, but fox hunting is many, many times more dangerous than motor racing ever was.
Yeah, but it's cool. Yeah, I agree. Because
and it hasn't got any safer, and there's no way of making it safer.
It's true. Jumping over, I think it's the fact that you're on essentially a wild animal pretending to be tame.
Yep.
That's part of the problem. I suppose that engineered cars are to a degree quite similar, and you know where you are with them, whereas you don't with a horse. And also, you're going around a track.
Yeah.
Well, you're not on. Yeah, I see that. But I, nevertheless, I do think that possibly there is within us Delingpoles a kind of maybe we're slightly more devil may care than normal people.
Well, I think all three of you boys are now far more cautious than you were a year or two ago.
Well, yeah, it's because we're a bit older and we've got sort of wives or girlfriends, and we've got all this ghastly parental responsibility and stuff. I mean, you do slow down a bit, don't you, when you get older. Tell me, at least three people wanted to know, which is your favourite son?
Well, there is a ready answer to that. I do have a favourite son,
but
don't ask me which one it is, but by the time this broadcast comes out, it will be a different one.
Is that how it goes?
Yeah, it's never the same one 2 weeks running.
Is that because you're slightly mentally erratic, or is it just because that's the way it is with parents?
No, because that week, that particular son might have been polite or respectful.
So is that how it goes? What, you're constantly shifting us in your league table, depending on whether we've...
Yeah.
You're quite a demanding father, yes, I would say.
A phone call from one of my sons and he moves up two notches.
Blimey. One of the things I do envy you, Pa, I really do envy you this, is you're having five children. I mean, I think I know the answer to this question already, but is being a father the thing you enjoy most about the world?
Absolutely,
life?
Yes, yeah.
That's
something
touching,
I always wanted to be, and having five children, nothing could make me happier.
Yeah, that's good. I suppose because you get the excitement of, well, you get more variety, don't you? You watch them and you think, wow, he's good at this and she's good at that. And
yes, they have very little in common except they're all Delingpoles.
I know. Isn't it weird?
Yeah.
How we are all completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, if you'd gone on breeding, who knows what you might have produced? You've got you've got me. I'm the what son? I'm the, apart from the eldest son,
erudite.
Erudite. Okay. Right. Okay. And then there's Dick, who's
imaginative.
Okay. And Charlie
just wants to make lots of money, which he's very good at.
He's so good at it, isn't he? How good is Charlie at making money? He's just like a money-making machine.
He is, absolutely.
And the weird thing about Charlie, I almost daren't ask him to have him on the podcast. Maybe he will come on one day. But one of the weird things about Charlie is that even though he's really good at money, like a lot of very, very successful people, he doesn't really care about spending it that much. He's not... I mean, I'd spend his money much better than he could.
Yeah. Fortunately, he's got a very beautiful girlfriend who has also got a very good job, and she whisks him off on fantastic city breaks.
But even she is not... We don't want to embarrass him too much by talking about him, but even his lovely girlfriend, she's not very materialistic. Not as...
Absolutely
she's
not.
One of,
no.
He could so easily have got a nightmare gold digger, and he hasn't.
No.
She's got somebody who's almost as frugal as he is.
She's perfect for him. She's a lovely girl, and they're great to be with.
Yeah. So you've got Charlie, who, with luck, when you fall into decrepitude, which I'm glad to say, I mean, you're 82, and you're going really strong. We'll come on to that in a minute. I mean, this is another thing I'm happy about, having you as my father. You're my genetic inheritance, and that's quite important. And actually, while we're on the subject of why you're a good father, another thing I like about you is that when I was growing up, even though I went through phases where I found you embarrassing, because every teenager finds his dad embarrassing at some stage, all my friends used to say, God, I love your dad. He's so cool. He's great to be. You were never one of those. You were very laissez-faire. You were never an authoritarian father. And I think possibly there was a phase where... we were quite wild, and we did swear quite a lot, and I do still swear quite a lot. But you let us roam free, pretty much, didn't you? Was that a personal philosophy, or was that just because you were just rubbish at discipline?
Good point. Was I rubbish at discipline? Yes, I suppose in the RAF I was rubbish at discipline. Yes, I've never been a disciplinarian.
Yes, well, I think we'll come on to your national service in a moment, because that was quite interesting. I have inherited from you your disciplinarian skills. I lack thereof, and I think you've observed it in the way that your grandchildren, the ones that I produced, wrap me around their little finger, the females especially, and that I'm absolutely hopeless at being a disciplinarian. And I once tried to be a disciplinarian. There was a period where the kids were being particularly annoying, and I sort of started shouting at them and telling them what to do, and they all looked at me and they said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to discipline you." And they said, "No, this is wife as well. We don't actually want you to do this. We don't like you when you're like this. We much prefer it when you're sitting there reading the newspaper and ignoring what's going on. That's the way you should be." So that's what I've done ever since, and I think it was the same for you.
Ah, that explains a lot. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, the downside of that is that you do get children who can be a pain in the arse sometimes. But I think the upside is that you set them free, don't you?
You reckon I set you free?
Well, I don't know. I look at some of the... Your generation of parents, I would say you were the least strict dad of anyone's dad that I knew.
Yeah.
And look at us. Aren't we all great?
Aren't you wonderful? Yes, yeah, I think so. But
yeah, yeah, exactly.
But you're all so different. So,
yeah. I still think that it would be a good idea. I first proposed this idea about like 5 years ago, that there should be a program, an upmarket Keeping Up with the Kardashians, called, I don't know, Living Down with the Dellingpoles or something. And I think we'd be really good. How would you be up for that if a TV producer was listening to this show and thinking, God, yeah, we really need a kind of high-end Kardashians?
Interesting thought. I haven't gone into it deeply.
You, as the paterfamilias, would be required to get a sex change at some point, you realise, like the head of the Kardashian family.
Right.
But that would be great TV.
Mm.
The only thing is, my worry about the Kardashians is you probably haven't even seen Keeping Up with the Kardashians, have you?
I haven't, no.
No. The problem is that it's all very heavily scripted, and also having cameras intruding in your life every time would be tiresome. I'm not sure that we'd be able to monetize it that successfully. I'm not sure the market would be... Mm. So we'll drop that up. Drop that
for now, yes.
Oh, now this is a question. Before we have our break, our first break, somebody asked me, why did you send me to Malvern?
Yeah, I remember reading that question.
Quite left field.
I was at Bromsgrove.
Yeah.
And I was very disappointed with it. But I had two friends, Ted Gray and Steve Morley, who are old Malvernians. And they spoke so highly about Malvern College, I thought, if I have sons, I want them to go there.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't regret it.
No. Well, the person who asked that question, actually, who's going to be on this podcast at some stage, has this theory, because I think his dad went to Malvern or something like that. And he has this theory, I don't know whether it's true, that one of the reasons I'm the way I am, one of the reasons that I am so kind of utterly against authority, or rather unearned authority, and the reason I'm constantly railing against the corrupt elite, is that there's something in the Malvern water, something in that school that encourages this attitude. I think that's what he was getting at, or possibly it's the other way around. Maybe he thought that the school was so kind of disciplined and sort of Victorian public school that actually it creates rebels who react against it. I don't know what his line was.
Well, I mean, I didn't go to Malvern. You three yeah. did, and it certainly changed a lot between the time you and Dick were there and some years later when Charlie went. But it's remained consistently a good school.
Yeah. I'm certainly very happy with my education there. All my English teachers... I mean, the level of the Oxbridge tuition at Malvern in my day was really good, and hey, I got into Oxford, and if I hadn't, I'd have a massive chip on my shoulder for the rest of my life, like all the people who didn't go to Oxford. I mean, people say I talk about it too much, but actually, I think it's partly this sense of surprise I've had ever since the day that the envelope arrived, telling me I'd got in. This weird sensation of bloody hell, it happened.
Do you ever wish you'd gone to Eton?
It's something I've often pondered over the years, because you remember when I went up to Oxford, I suddenly became conscious of the fact that I had been to what was known to the people who'd been to Westminster and Eton and Winchester and so on. I'd been to a minor public school.
MPS, and, as your son refers.
MPS. And up until that point, I thought, well, I'm just a public school boy and I'm privately educated and I'm as good as anyone. And suddenly I was made to feel quite small. So I went through this phase where I was trying to live, you remember this, where my accent got stupidly posh,
yeah.
And I hammed everything up, and I was a bit like how Evelyn Waugh felt in the 1930s. I was conscious that I was not as posh as I wanted to be. I wished I'd been to Eton or similar, and I wished my father were a duke and not a mere Midlands industrialist. Now that was in the 1980s. After Brideshead Revisited. Since then, I've had a kind of complete volte-face where I'm actually really happy that I come from the background I do and had the education I did, because I can mix it up with both worlds. I've entered the world of toffery. I've hung out with the upper classes. I've done the upper class pursuits. I've had the upper class education and all that. At the same time, I'm bloody glad I come from the West Midlands and I come from an industrial family, because I have an insight into a world that actually I rather respect far more. I don't idolise the toffs in the way I used to, because actually, you know what? I think a lot of them would happily sell the rest of the country out. It goes back to the days of the Napoleonic Wars. Quite a lot of the Whiggish aristocracy would have been perfectly happy running England as a sort of satrapy of the Napoleonic Empire. They, as long as they kept their states, they wouldn't have given a toss. And it's the same with the upper classes now who've supported Brexit. They would very happily sell their country down the river. Don't care if the country is run by the unelected bureaucrats from the European Union, just so long as they keep their grants for their estates. That's all they bloody care about. I'm not dissing all the toffs, but what I am saying is I prefer the horny-handed sons of toil, people like you, people like my Uncle Purse, who made their money selling nuts and bolts, doing proper jobs, weren't dependent on the states, on the state. Fair point?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I mean, most of the people I know in Malvern are, inverted commas, academics.
Yes, I mean, aren't they the worst?
And they're all extreme lefties.
Yeah.
Believe in the myth of anthropogenic
global warming. Yeah.
And such like.
Yeah.
And remaining in the European Union.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, so I think that one of the reasons, because there were so few journalists, really, who came out for Brexit during the campaign. I remember going to the premiere of Brexit the movie.
Yeah.
And we were all gathered together, you know, people like me and Charles Moore and all the other, you know, I mean, I can't remember, list all the names now, Toby Young. But I thought, if a bomb goes off now in this cinema, that is England's best hope gone, because we're all here in one building and we all felt like we were part of something. And most of the chattering classes were against us.
Mm, absolutely.
I mean, Brexit for me was a bit like the which side would you have fought on at what's the battle they always say? Not Marston Moor, the other one. But you know, or even which side would you have been on in the Civil War? It was the defining issue of.
Well, you are actually the only journalist who got both Brexit and the Trump victory right, aren't you?
Well, yeah, you're pretty much. I mean, one of passing few. No, even now, no English journalist wants to admit to being
pro-Trump.
Pro-Trump.
No.
Well, do you know what, Pa? We've done really well. I know you were quite nervous about this. You thought it's going to be hard. I mean, you're finding it very easy, in fact, but you were worried. As anyone would in his 80s, who's never done a podcast with James Dalrymple before. You know, you and Norman Tebbit, basically. We've come already to the end of the first section. So, you're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very, very, very special guest, Malcolm Dellingpole, my dad.
Sunny Johnson brings her cutting-edge conservative commentary to SiriusXM Patriot every week on Sunny's Corner.
I didn't learn conservatism from Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, or Mark Levin. No conservative showed up in my school, my neighborhood, or anywhere in my intellectual orbit. I got all my conservatives from my unknowing but conservative principle-practicing family and hip-hop.
Sunny's Corner, every Saturday at noon East on Breitbart News Saturday. SiriusXM Patriot 125.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very, very special guest, my dad, Malcolm Dellingpole. Pa, I've got to ask you about your exciting career, your national service career, because it was quite unconventional. I mean, I was slightly full of regret in my early days that you hadn't done what Michael Caine did. And Michael Caine joined an infantry regiment and then found himself surrounded by the Chinese and the Korean War and managed to sort of fight his way out. That would have been more exciting to tell my friends. But what you did was pretty cool, wasn't it, nonetheless?
Yes, it all happened accidentally. I knew I'd got to do national service. So I looked around at something which I thought I might be reasonably good at. I always enjoyed languages at school, so I got a Polish chap who lived on the Russian border to teach me Russian. I was doing very well at that. By the time I finished square bashing, "What do you want to do, Dellingpole?" "I want to go on the Russian course, sir." "Oh, slight problem. The Russian course is full. But we can offer you Chinese, Mandarin." "What's that involved?" "We send you to London University for 12 months in civvies, then we ship you out to Hong Kong." So I said, "Right, I think I'll sign on. Where do I sign?" So I became a regular rather than just a national serviceman and signed on for 5 years.
And this is why, I mean, one reason you didn't become an officer, but this wasn't for officers, was it? This was for NCOs, I think.
Consideration of whether you're officer material was a separate consideration.
Right.
It's whether you had a linguistic ability.
Right. Well, yeah. So you swanned around London for a year, learning Mandarin. When I imagine that a lot of people's national service experience was pretty grim. It was all about sort of painting stones, whitewashing stones, and polishing your boots. Whereas I imagine in the RAF it was pretty slack, wasn't it?
I don't think so. I think we were as smart as anybody.
Right. But you went out to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And you sat on top of Victoria Peak.
Yeah. There was three shifts a day from 5 in the morning till midday or whatever it was. So there's the morning, the afternoon, and the night shift, sitting there listening to the Chinese Air Force.
And what were they saying to each other, these Chinese pilots?
Okay to take off. My sound okay? In other words, it was all very boring, but basically, had there been a hot war, had a hot war broken out, we would have been incredibly important.
Well, so what were you listening out for? Variations on the normal conversations?
Well, basically, the nationalists based in Taiwan, were flying saber jets over Communist China on leaflet raids, and the MiGs would set up, take off to chase them back to Taiwan again, and we would record the movements.
I see, right. So probably you also had a hot war broken out, you would have been a massive target sitting on your listening post on Hong Kong, which is dangerously close.
Well, basically the Chinese could have closed Hong Kong down at any time they wanted.
Hong Kong? What was Hong... This is what,
1954? 1950s, yeah.
What was Hong Kong like then?
I dug this book out, which tells me what Hong Kong was like then. Yeah. Yes, it was fun. We used to go downtown, sit in bars and chat up girls buy them drinks.
I mean, it wasn't the bustling metropolis it is today, was it?
No,
I mean, it wasn't.
No.
Was it even high rise?
I think the tallest building was about, I think there were some even as high as 5 stories in those days. Yes.
Imagine it, because you were the son of a reasonably wealthy industrialist, and you had your own car. You had it shipped out, didn't you?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Right. I had when I was in the UK, I had the Mark II Delo, which would have been perfect for Hong Kong, because you could actually get 4 people in it. Unfortunately, when they tried to ship it out to me, the dockers or somebody at the docks stripped it of every possible part, headlamps, etc., and it went back to the factory. And my father and his partner, Ron Lowe, hence the name Delo, Dellingpole Lowe, decided to send me the Racing Mark V, which was not suitable for Hong Kong. It would only take 2 people. You couldn't possibly get a 3rd or 4th person in. And it was not designed for hill climbing. But as you know well, Hong Kong is very hilly.
Right.
So I had this Mark V out there, and I drove it in the Macau Grand Prix.
Right. Was it suitable for Grand Prix?
Well, I think the word Grand Prix must be put in italics. I had a full Portuguese international racing license handed to me so that I could drive.
Yeah.
It was great fun, but the car blew up after 3 or 4 laps.
Right, I see.
But I can say I've driven in a Grand Prix.
Yeah, well, that's not many of us can say that. Yes, I imagine there's going to be a few petrol heads who want to know a bit about the history of the Delo, because hey, I mean, this is part of my heritage. I am the great grandson of a bloke who co-invented this car.
Well, no, you're the
Ken Dellingpole was my grandfather.
Yeah, okay. So, but Bill Dellingpole, I think, was the director at one stage.
Right,
his father.
And the Delo is kind of, well, there are different marks as we've established, but it's a fun car, isn't it? It's like a sort of noddy car.
It was designed for mud plugging, for trials.
Right. What is a trial?
A trial is a hill climb up a muddy track.
Right. Timed. So you all.
No, it's in sections.
Right.
So it's the difficulty of getting up the muddy track.
Right.
It's so designed that you've got to be very clever to get to the top.
Right. What? So you've got to have kind of good low gears. Or is it more than
well, you've
that?
Got to have the engine as far back as possible.
Yeah,
you've got to have tyres as low as possible pressure. You've got to have a heavy passenger who's prepared to bounce up and down like mad, so yeah, that you're constantly getting grip. Great fun.
This sounds to me like a sort of 50s thing that people don't do anymore.
Presumably they do, but yeah.
I mean, you think of all the things that have been, all the sports that have been invented since, like kite surfing and, I don't know, all these, what else they've invented? Well, everything they've invented since the 1950s. I mean, there wasn't really much by way of entertainment, was there, in those days?
Well, if we could talk for a moment or two longer about the Delo, it
yeah.
was basically, we built 300 of them.
Yeah.
And I think about 275 are still going strong. Those who've got them get great enjoyment out of them. They still do the 3 main trials, the Land's End, the Exeter, and the Edinburgh. You can still buy a Delo for about £7,000. They've never appreciated greatly in value because it was a Ford engine, old side valve Ford engine. The bits are readily available. What happened was people used to bring in their broken down or written off Ford Prefect or Anglia, We would get rid of the body, put the engine and axles onto a rocket tube chassis, put an aluminium body on, and hey presto, you'd got a nice little sports car. And a number of very wealthy men today swear by their first car, which was a Dello.
Yes, I want to be one of those people with a Dello. I think it'd be wrong if I don't get one. Yeah, so I want a Dello, and unfortunately, you haven't got one that you're going to bequeath me.
No.
But you haven't got much generally you're going to bequeath me, have you? But one of the good things about that, by the way, about, you know, the fact that you haven't got a vast fortune, is that we Delling Pole children, you're more used to us alive than dead.
Well, it's my genes you're after.
Yeah, yeah.
You've the genetic inheritance. The longer I live, the longer you think you're going to live.
Is that the most important thing you think a father can give to his children, his genes? Or do you think there are... What are the other things that a father needs to give his children? Money, obviously not being one of them in your case.
No, I think genetic inheritance is probably the most important.
Right, right. Yeah, you haven't got... I'm bloody glad you haven't got Alzheimer's yet.
Well,
I mean, some of your friends have, and it's younger friends, and that's really... That's got to be the worst, hasn't it?
Alzheimer's, yes. I can't imagine anything anywhere near as bad as Alzheimer's. No, it's horrendous.
I mean, presumably you don't know. Well, you do, I suppose in the early stages you didn't even got it. I mean, living with somebody with Alzheimer's must be, while on the subject of AD, I mean, how do you stay? Because you're pretty fit on your. On your pins, aren't you? You're nimble. Given that the big pot belly you've got, I mean, how do you do it? What's your secret?
Having a girlfriend, oblique stroke partner for the last 21 years, who introduced me to walking as a hobby.
Were you not you were not a big walker before then?
No. No, until I went to live in Malvern and joined Malvern Footpath Society and Tewkesbury Walking Club, I did no walking at all.
Because you are, I mean, it's funny that I hadn't realised that, because you're such an obsessive walker now. You walk like how many paces, I mean, how much do you walk a day, roughly?
4 or 5 miles a day, normally, yeah.
Yeah, you and James Lovelock, I mean, James Lovelock, to be fair, is 98, whereas you're a mere stripling of 83, or 82.
Well, it's probably what's kept him going, yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it, that it is as simple as that?
Is it as simple as that? I think it's genetic.
Right. And your diet is not especially good or bad, I don't think.
I eat what I want when I want.
Right.
Living by myself.
You've never smoked, have you?
Yes, briefly, when everybody smoked.
I bet you're a really crap smoker.
Oh, I was, yeah, absolutely crap smoker. Yeah.
And are you was a crap drinker as well?
No, I enjoy a pint with your brother every Wednesday, pint and a half with your brother every Wednesday.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, that's about all we can hold, isn't it, with Delling Poles? We can't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A pint and a half.
Yeah, or a couple of glasses of wine a night, yeah.
Yeah. And you've never, unlike me, you've never dabbled with drugs?
No.
You mean you haven't taken any, have you?
When I get...
Oh, so you
when
have.
When I go and stop with my children.
That's right,
yes.
I've forgotten about that. You have.
Yes.
But that's your children who corrupted you, not... Yeah. Exactly. But, even though you lived through the 1960s, I suspect that your experience of the 60s was much more typical than the one we read about in history books. Yeah, there's this impression one gets now that everyone was wearing beads and caftans in 1968 and taking LSD and going to see the Rolling Stones. And actually, probably they were a tiny minority, and most of them were people like you going on living rather staid lives.
Yes, I don't think I ever went through any of those phases, no.
Right. Another of the questions on the list is, what was your favourite decade? What was your favourite period of your life?
Oh. About the time you were born, I think.
What, 65?
If that's when you were born, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Life was pretty good. Well, I'd got my independence, my own home, a Porsche 911, and a son.
Yes.
Porsche 911 was incredibly desirable then.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I never had one of those.
No.
You've had way better cars than me, Pa.
Yeah, but... okay, so... Today, I mean, I enjoy my little Romanian-made Dacia as much as...
Is it pronounced Dacia, not Dacia?
No, it's Dacia.
Dacia.
Well, it's after the Dacian tribe. Because,
oh, is it? Rather than as in the Russian...
But it's pronounced Dacia
cottage.
As in a Russian oligarch's villa. Yeah.
Okay. So, okay, you wrote a little sort of book thing, which I encourage you to do, a sort of your autobiography. And you said something rather interesting about your view of life now, that you're really quite happy in your 80s, because you're sort of free of all the kind of
baggage. I think I mentioned that joining the U3A, University of the Third Age, for people who don't know about it, was the best thing that happened to me in my declining years. Malvern U3A is one of the biggest in the country, 80 different groups, 1,200 members. If there isn't something to keep you busy there, you're a pretty sad person. I started two groups. The first one was China Studies. I assembled a few people. I said, right, we're starting a China Studies group. Answer these questions. Which do you want to do? Do you want to learn the language? Do you want to learn how to write Chinese? Or do you want to know about life in China today? And almost to a woman, and they were virtually all women, said they wanted to know about life in China today. So I bought every book on the subject, particularly Yung Chang's Life of Mao. I studied it, and I produced a talk every month, and I finally took two parties from Malvern U3A into China. So going up the Yangtze and Beijing, Shanghai, etc. on the one trip, and along the Silk Road on the other trip.
Yeah, you're lucky that way. You've seen China when I haven't. Although it's not highest on my list of places that. I mean, I'd rather see more of India and more of Southeast Asia and stuff before I see China. I don't know. I'm worried about the food.
Huh? No. I was told beforehand Chinese food is... But no, I love Chinese food and I never had a lousy meal anywhere in China.
Okay, aren't they a bit like lacking in social skills, a bit unfriendly, a legacy of communism?
No, I'm an acute Sinophile.
You are, aren't you? Yeah.
I'm afraid I will defend them regardless.
What, even if we went to war with them? Whose side will you be on? This is the equivalent of Norman Tebbit's cricket test.
Cricket test.
Who
yes.
would you? You'd be well, rooting. You, I bet you, Pa. You'd be bloody rooting for the Chinese, wouldn't you?
Well,
for the Slopes.
As they don't play cricket, the Norman Tebbit test doesn't apply. No, I think they are. What the word is? Pragmatic. I think that one adjective sums right. up the Chinese to a T. I think ever since, I mean, to my mind, the greatest statesman of the last century was Deng Xiaoping, who uttered the immortal words, "To grow rich is wonderful." From that day on, the Chinese became entrepreneurs.
Well, Peter Mandelson said something similar, and I'm not sure that makes him a good person.
Yeah, but Deng Xiaoping, if you read his life story and what his... I mean, his eldest son was thrown from a top-story window and crippled for life. He was a very brave little man. The China today is his doing, not Mao Zedong's.
Right. Well, I just hope that when our new insect overlords take over, that you're still alive and you can kind of treat with them, and they'll probably be aware of your position on China. Perhaps it's like having Jim, my stepson, being married to a Hong Kong Chinese girl. I'm figuring that when they take over, I'm going to get sent to a preferential labor camp because of my connections with the...
I don't know where you're getting all this idea from.
Look, Chinese... don't forget, one of my bosses, Steve Bannon, he's got China's measure. He doesn't trust him at all.
He doesn't what?
He doesn't trust the Chinese. He thinks they're a mess. I don't know. Because I've got you, my father, versus Steve Bannon, my boss. He probably gets access to bigger, better intelligence briefings than you do. But you're my dad. So who knows? Who knows? Anyway, look, we're not gonna resolve this one. You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very, very, very special daddy guest, Malcolm Dellingpole.
Hey folks, I want to tell you about Breitbart News Second Amendment newsletter, Downrange with AWR Hawkins. Features the top gun stories of the week every week, and guest columnists like Gun Owners of America's Larry Pratt or Armed American Radio's Mark Walters. Also features a review of a firearm or a firearm accessory each week. The newsletter downloads on Thursday, comes right to your email inbox. You can subscribe at Breitbart.com/AWR.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very, very special fatherly daddy guest, my father, Malcolm Dellingpole. We haven't got round to probably the biggest burning issue of the day, which is dog poo gate. Whose fault do you think it was that you ended up treading in dog poo that night of the curry?
Well, it was yours.
It was mine. Right, okay.
If you recall, as we left the house,
yes,
I said, I'm just going to have a pee. And you said, surely you're not going to pee in the garden.
And you misheard.
I thought you said, have a pee in the garden.
Yes, because Dick had locked up the house at that point, and he was saying, I'm not going to let you back in now, Pa. You should have gone when I said, in that way that Dick... Everyone thinks, by the way, Pa, everyone thinks Dick is really lovely. Do you know this? Everyone thinks he's the nicer brother. He's so gentle. He's not like you. He's not all spiky and angry. They don't know him. I think he's got a way of presenting himself. But he's much stricter with us than I am.
He's much stricter with his kids than you are.
But stricter with his kids.
I don't know whether it's better.
And with his father. He told you off as well.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't let you back into the house, even though, look, a man of 82, he wouldn't let you back, forcing you to go into his darkened, dog poo-covered garden.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. You blame me for saying that, but what about the man who lets his dogs poo willy-nilly all over his lawn and doesn't clear it? What about that? Those foul lurchers that he loves so much.
I thought we weren't going to mention the word lurcher.
I know.
I mean, it might just as well have been a spaniel.
I think that... all I'll say
this is... This could be called Lurchergate, but...
Do you know, I have a depressing feeling that even though there are certain... Some people will be fascinated by the Dello, the fact that, you know, petrol heads and your connection with it and stuff. And some people will be mildly interested, I guess, in your stuff about China and about Hong Kong and stuff. I reckon most people, what they really want is just this kind of Dellingpole shit stirring. They would just want to know the juicy details about Dellingpole's behaving badly and sibling rivalry. Somebody wants to know about sibling rivalry. Is there sibling rivalry among your children?
Yes, get them together. Yes, not a good idea. I think they're best handled independently.
Is that right?
What? Yeah, well, it's probably... We do it once a year.
Yeah.
We meet at the Chase in on the Malvern Hills.
Yeah.
And for 2 hours... The entire family is there being nice to each other. We have a walk beforehand.
It's quite hard, that bit. We have to be nice to each other.
Yeah, well, I think you can probably just manage to be nice to each other for 2 hours.
But, Pa, some of the children that you've bred, some of them have left-wing politics and green politics, for God's sake. How did that happen? What did you do wrong there? You've bred not one, but two daughters... who have really, really dodgy politics.
Well, perhaps the one survived, lives in Brighton, and it doesn't really pay to be right wing in Brighton.
So you think, yeah, you think it's a survival mechanism?
Or did they go to Brighton because they're left wingers?
Or is it because they're... it seems to me that the female line of Dellingpoles are more predisposed towards stupid lefty politics than the male ones generally.
Yes, I mean, we don't know what Charlie's politics are.
No. Charlie's a businessman. Business people are politically neutral because they want to accommodate themselves to whatever regime's going. Yeah. All they care about is the business environment. It's an interesting facet about business people.
Yeah. Oh, I think he's absolutely right to be that way. I don't think he could do what you're doing at the same time doing what he is doing.
No, but I'd be bloody useless at what I'd be doing if I had his politics, wouldn't I? I mean, I imagine not having a kind of
view on everything.
View on everything. Yeah. Whereas I think there aren't many issues where I don't have a view.
No.
Do I get that from you or from mother or from where?
I don't know. I mean, Charlie probably has a view, but he's not going to express it.
No, he's not, no.
Because it doesn't get him anywhere.
I like the way Charlie uses words like suboptimal.
Yeah.
Isn't that a wonderful business word and a fantastic low-key put down?
Yeah.
I used it on somebody once, and I really loved using it. That solution is suboptimal, I said, and it was just like so witheringly... contemptuous. Did you think I was going to end up doing this kind of rubbish career that I do?
Well, even you thought you were destined for a career in the city.
We're talking about when I did the milk round in my last year at university, and I thought, yeah, that was what everyone else was doing. This was just before Big Bang, wasn't it? So inevitably, that was where people were going. But I also went through periods where I wanted to be an archaeologist, where I wanted to be a barrister, where I wanted to be in the SAS. None of those came off.
Well, don't you think you were always destined for the literary world?
Yeah, but are you kind of happy with the way I've turned out? Leading question.
It doesn't matter whether I'm happy or not. That's what you are. I love you all equally, and you are as you are. It's not really up to me to say... Ooh, I wish James had been a fighter pilot or a... I don't know. You became a journalist, and I'm happy enough with that.
Right. Do you think... Who made you... Did you give me your politics, or did I give you mine?
I think I get my politics from you. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you were less...
I was apolitical, I think, before you entered the political arena, and I read your books and your articles and followed you in the Telegraph. Yes, sir.
So I red-pilled my dad. Tell me, because there are mixed reports on this. Was I always political, or did it sort of express itself later on in my life?
I think you'll have to tell me that.
Oh, great. So two old men trying to remember something they can't. Because some people say to me, oh, I remember you when you were younger and you weren't at all political. I think I just didn't feel the need to express my views.
Well, I mean, you look at your contemporaries at Oxford, you know.
They're all Boris
sellouts. Boris Pump.
They're all sellouts. Every one of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Even Gove, by the way.
Gove
has his recent thing on neonicotinoids, and I did try and say to him, Gove, look, you're going to be got at by these people, and I can see why they do it. It's the green lobby are so, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, they are so entrenched and so powerful, particularly within the EU, of course, but with the apparatus of state generally, that, of course, if you're going to be... if there's any way as a conservative that you can get in with them, it's going to be, hey, look, see how open-minded I am. I can, we're not anti-environmentalist. Yeah, well, none of us is anti-environmentalist, but actually, if we read the science and look at the facts, we're not going to support this bullshit like banning neonicotinoids.
No, absolutely not. I mean, yes, he has sold out, but I didn't know whether we were going to get round to this. I mean, I didn't know how disappointed you were with what he's done.
I'm really gutted. I still love him, and I would still be happy if he became prime minister. But it's just like, you know, what things are, well, actually, I'm not going to ask you what things I've done that have disappointed me. But, you know, when your son does something stupid, it's just like, you know, beneath your expectations of him. That's how I feel about Gove. It's just like sad. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, still, JRM is the only one.
Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yeah, is the only one who seems totally...
Jacob, this is what upset me about... The only thing that upset me about my podcast with Tebow last week... Tebow, by the way, looks a lot like you, Lord Tebow. The only disappointment was where he didn't root for Jacob Rees-Mogg in the way that I might have hoped. And his line was, Jacob Rees-Mogg, not having had any ministerial experience, was therefore unsuited to jumping into the office of Prime Minister. Which I think is... You could make that argument about Donald Trump. You could say he's never been a senator. He's never been even a congressman
or a district councillor.
Yeah, district councillor. Well, hey, it hasn't stopped him being like one of the greatest presidents ever.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's going to piss off so many people, isn't it? Apart from all the listeners of this show who I think kind of love Trump. There is too much of an obsession. I feel. Certainly with our media class, and apparently even with Lord Tebbit, with this idea that you've got to pay your dues and
what, work your way up the ladder.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the fact that Jacob Rees-Mogg is untainted by having to compromise and be got at by civil servants, these seem to me eminently... eminent qualifications for being prime minister.
Absolutely.
He's just going to be his own man, and you can never ever imagine Jacob Rees-Mogg doing something purely in order to make himself look nicer with whoever he everything he does is about principle. We're both pausing here to just think how wonderful it would be if Jacob Rees-Mogg got to be.
Well, I mean, that's why Trump is so such a breath of fresh air.
Do you ever meet anyone apart from me and Dick who thinks Trump is great?
Yes, I have a married lady friend in Malvern who we
you have your special Trump time with.
we talk daily about she follows Judicial Watch and any other site that's pro-Trump, right. And we discuss it, but nobody else at all.
Because there aren't many. There's still
our philosophical discussion group. There's just the two of us in that circle who are pro-Trumpers.
Yeah. What do you like about him?
He is an absolute breath of fresh air, and well, of course, more than anything. He has not gone along with the Paris Climate Convention.
Yeah, that's
I mean, that's
great.
The finest thing. If he's remembered for anything, I hope it will be the appointment of Scott Pruitt and what those two have achieved together.
I know. I was down on Scott Pruitt in some of his early days because I think he rightly so. I mean, I was getting briefings from people within the EPA that he wasn't quite on top of the job, but he seems to be doing pretty well. So Trump was right to pull out of Paris. And I don't think it's just...
Well, he can't pull out, can he? I mean, in the paper this morning, it was he's stuck there till for another year or two. But he's playing it brilliantly. He's making them now talk about fossil fuels instead of renewables.
Hang on. I've just got to pause it here because you know why? I'm getting a sugar low. I'm not getting all the words out. Do you get this at all?
What?
If you haven't eaten enough. Yeah. No. It can get really bad.
I know your son.
Yes, my son. No, I get it as well. I get hypoglycemic and I just go all doolally and I can tell when my vocabulary starts going. That I know I'm in trouble. And it happened on any questions once. It's really nightmare. Hang on, just so back after a bit of toast. After that little breakette, that was because I was having a hyperglycemic episode and I needed... I got some of my delicious... You've tried it, didn't you, Pa? What do you think of it, of my special sourdough loaf?
Excellent, excellent.
I mean, aren't you proud to produce a baker of that calibre?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I had sourdough, homemade sourdough bread with almond butter and Greek honey. How about that? So I'm feeling revived and ready to tackle the last questions. That now, this was an interesting question. This was a latecomer from somebody who follows me on Twitter but very rarely tweets. And he wanted you to talk about the development of the British industrial fastener industry, 1970 to 1988. Do you know who that person might have been?
I wonder who that could have been. It could have been someone who, when he first started out on his business career, said, "Look, Pa, I want you to sit down and write down every mistake you ever made in business." And I realized then how serious he was. So I went through my entire business career in, which was always in what are now called industrial fasteners, but we used to call bolts and nuts. And I unearthed everything that had gone wrong. He says, "Well, I need to know, because when I start my business career, I don't want to make any of those mistakes."
He is so meticulous, isn't he? I think all those people out there who look at entrepreneurs and they think, "Oh well, if I'd been in the right place at the right time, I too would have made all that money." Well, maybe, but certainly my experience of watching Charlie build up his businesses, he is meticulous, he is driven, he has got an eye for every tiny detail. He's just on the ball all the time. And I couldn't do what he does. I think you need a particular mindset to be able to do it.
I think his greatest secret is that he surrounds himself with what you might call greybeards, people with a lot more experience who've succeeded in their business life, and he listens to what they say.
Yeah. He does. He listens, actually, when he listens to you, he listens to you with an almost disturbing intensity. I mean, I'm quite flippant, and I think this is both a blessing and a curse. It's given me a disdain for people who take themselves too seriously and an endless ability to just take the piss out of people, which obviously people find entertaining, and also if they're in positions of power, they deserve a bit of lèse majesté. But Charlie hasn't got that flippant streak to the same degree, and he's benefited from that financially.
He can be a piss taker.
Oh, yeah, he can. Yeah,
can be totally ruthless if he thinks you're being pompous.
Yes.
But he does listen.
Yeah, he does. He does. I think we won't go into too much detail about the nut and bolt industry of the... It could be quite a niche topic, do you think, perhaps?
Okay, so I spent all my business career in the nut and bolt industry, but it's gone.
Yeah.
It's all made abroad. China was able to move in with equally good equipment, but with labor rates one-tenth of those.
Yeah, exactly. They've kept the renminbi low, haven't they? They've sort of inherited all the global production.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is, I suppose, clever if you're not... Clever if you're a Chinese person wanting to earn a living in the manufacturing industry, but not so good if you're in Europe or America trying to make
compete
money.
Compete with them. No, yeah. Absolutely not. You can't.
Yeah, exactly. Now, somebody wants to know your views on species extinction.
Well, it just ain't happening. I once did a thorough survey on this, and I find there are, out of the X million species on Earth, in our lifetime, there are 21 species that have actually disappeared. And it's questionable whether some of those actually ever existed as independent species.
Right. Yes. So what, they're just kind of variants of the same thing, really?
Well, it's probably not the place to go into it at great depth, but if you take Gambusia, the mosquito fish, these were collected, and when it was found out that malaria was caused by mosquitoes, any pond or a larger body of water, Gambusia, the mosquito fish, were introduced. And centuries later, or tens of years later, they were regarded as independent species, but almost certainly they'd been introduced by man to get rid of mosquito larvae.
It's a bit of a curveball to throw at you at the end of the podcast. You almost need your notes with you. I mean, but another of our favourites is the Aldabran banded snail.
Yes,
the one that was allegedly extinct but then got rediscovered because
it emerged 7 years later because scientists were too lazy to go and examine Aldabra.
I think you would have been, rather than being in the nut and bolt industry, you'd have been much happier, ironically, as a zoologist or something like that, wouldn't you?
Because, absolutely, yes.
Because that was how my strongest memories of childhood with you are going to exotic places around the world and collecting reptiles and amphibians for our collection, for your lizard house.
Yes, there was that classic occasion when there was this island off Mallorca, way out to sea, where we knew there was a unique race of black lizards.
A melanistic form of Lacerta...
Muralis, yeah. It was solid with them. And
it
only
was a
tiny
island, wasn't it? I mean, really small.
Yeah. And the only way to get to it was on a pedalo. So I sat out with you, your brother and your sister, who was very little then, and we pedaloed out to this island.
It was very irresponsible behavior. I mean, that was one of the things I liked about you, about having you as a father. You were pretty irresponsible, and you took. I mean, it was a long way offshore, wasn't it? And it was a hard journey.
Yeah, with you two pedaling.
I can still feel, as we're talking about it, I can actually feel the muscles in my legs sort of straining in sympathy. And we got to this island and it was crawling with these black lizards.
And we took a bucket, a rotten banana and some honey. We smeared the honey around the inside of the... No, it was margarine or butter we smeared around the inside of the bucket. We attached a long length of cord... put the rotten banana in the bottom and waited for it to fill with lizards.
It didn't take long, did it? Because these lizards were so tame, they actually crawled. They had no fear of humans.
No.
They crawled all over you.
We filled two pillowcases full of black lizards and pedaloed back to the mainland.
Yeah. I wonder if there are any of these black lizards in collections now. And I wonder, actually, whether all it would take is one shipwrecked cat. A pregnant shipwrecked cat to wipe out that entire colony forever. Yes. And that melanistic strain of Lacerta muralis would be gone.
Yes.
So technically, if those lizards went extinct, would that count as a species extinction? No, it wouldn't, would it? Because melanistic just means a sort of black sort of mutation.
I mean, I often check the IUCN red list to see how critically endangered something is. That list is pretty accurate, but it often gets distorted.
Can I just cite this conversation, actually? I get so much, you know I do, because you follow me on the internet and stuff. I get so much grief from the true believers in climate change and all these conservation biologists and ecologists with their worthless I'll have an extra large fries with that degrees from the University of East Anglia, and they all think that they have this monopoly on scientific understanding and they have this monopoly on love of the environment and love of the natural world. And I have to say, guys, my dad and I we've been interested in this shit for at least as long as you have.
Absolutely.
We care about the natural world. You know, I'm with Matt Ridley on this one. Matt did zoology.
He's great.
He gets it. He understands it in the way that Michael Gove doesn't. That it is quite possible to love nature, be interested in the natural world, like walking and all the things that we enjoy doing, without buying into all that kind of eco-Nazi shit that we've had fed to us by
But there's no money in our view.
No.
There's X trillion
yes.
on the other side of the argument. Mm. So if you want to enjoy educating your kids privately, having expensive holidays, you go on that side of the argument.
Exactly. Well, the one question we haven't asked, we may as well ask it just to round up off the podcast, is Judge Dredd or Rogue Trooper or Nemesis? Who's your favourite?
I saw you'd got that on the list. I mean, I used to read Judge Dredd, but honestly, I haven't followed the others, so...
Well, you used to read them, you've just forgotten, because you were an avid 2008 AD reader.
Yeah. But I don't remember the characters. I met Mega City 1 and all that sort of thing.
And you remember Splundig Verthrig?
Yes.
And you remember Congratulations, Agent Rat, Another Triumph?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, on that slightly pathetic note, I think we should conclude this otherwise generally wonderful podcast. You're listening to the Dellingpole Podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very, very, very special daddy guest, Malcolm Dellingpole. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.